From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a conversation with Senator Bernie Sanders and his hopes for reform after Election Day.
Now, you and I may disagree on an issue, but I hope we can agree that one person, one vote is what American democracy is. It's not about people with huge sums of money buying elections.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes on the transformation from Detroit water and sewerage to the Great Lakes Water Authority.
I don't think there's any question that you're getting more transparency and the place is going to be better managed.
From attorney to newspaper columnist to a writer out with her first book of short stories, we hear from author Desiree Cooper.
I think sometimes what fiction can do is articulate a truth that you just don't even dare talk about, or that maybe sometimes you think it's only you.
Those stories and more. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Still to come, the Great Lakes Water Authority seems to be performing the way its designers hoped it would.
This is one of the fruits of the bankruptcy, as I think of it.
But first, the next debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump happens this coming Sunday night. Senator Bernie Sanders is making several stops on Clinton's behalf today in Michigan, and he made some time to speak with Stateside. We sat down just before his rally at the University of Michigan campus. Senator, what's your message today to Michigan voters?
My message is get beyond personalities, get to the real issues facing the middle class and working class of this country. And if you do so, what you will conclude, in my view, is that Donald Trump would be a disaster as president and that on issue after issue, Hillary Clinton's position is progressive and will work for working families and the middle class.
When we wake up November 9th, no matter who wins, then what? How do we as a nation and our next president handle all this anger that's been stirred up during this campaign?
Well, I think one of the candidates is helping to stir up that anger. Look, people in America, in our democracy, can have different points of view. But no candidate for president should be running his campaign based on bigotry, based on insulting women, based on trying to divide us up if we're Muslims or whether we're Latinos, based on trying to tell the American people that our president, the first African-American president in our history, somehow was not a legitimate president. That's not how you run a campaign. You run a campaign based on the needs of the American people and your ideas on how to improve life for the American people. I think if people take a look at what Secretary Clinton is saying, making public colleges and universities tuition-free, raising the minimum wage, pay equity for women, rebuilding our infrastructure, expanding health care, on issue after issue, there really is no choice. She is far and away the superior candidate.
But that day after, even if she's the winner, no matter who's the winner, we've got a stirred up, angry nation.
We do. And I think what we have to do is to understand why people are angry. And I'll tell you why people are angry. There are good reasons to be angry. If I was out there today working longer hours for lower wages, if I could not afford to send my kids to college, and I could not afford health care, and I see almost all of the new income and wealth in this country going to the top 1%. You know what? I'm angry, and I have a right to be angry. So what we have to do is channel that anger in a productive way to create an economy that works for the middle class and working families. Getting angry at my neighbors doesn't help. Getting angry at Wall Street and starting to break up these huge financial institutions whose greed has caused so much harm to our problem, that's what we got to do.
And that anger has taken you and Donald Trump as outsider candidates and made you central to this campaign. What do you think this campaign cycle may do to change our electoral process, our political process?
Well, one thing I surely hope it will do, and Secretary Clinton has been very strong on this, and I want everybody to know this. In my view, we are moving toward an oligarchic form of society where a handful of billionaires are controlling not only our economy but our political life. What Clinton believes, and I believe, is that we have got to overturn this disastrous Citizens United Supreme Court decision. And what we're seeing right now, all over this country, are billionaires like the Koch brothers, Sheldon Adelson, and others literally buying elections. Now, you and I may disagree on an issue, but I hope we can agree that one person, one vote is what American democracy is. It's not about people with huge sums of money buying elections.
Do you think the two major parties can make a course adjustment to become more relevant to their bases?
Well, that's a good question. And I think that for too long, the United States Congress and the White House has been very separated from where the American people are. Now, in my view, and I think the facts are pretty clear, we have made good economic progress over the last 8 years. The automobile industry is a hell of a lot better today than it was 8 years ago. When Bush left office, we were losing 800,000 jobs a month. We're now gaining a few hundred thousand jobs a month. But, and here is the big but, despite those gains, there is no question that tens of millions of Americans are really hurting. They can't afford child care. They can't afford health care. They can't afford college education. They can't afford their prescription drugs because the drug companies are ripping us off. They're losing their jobs, going to Mexico, going to China. We got real problems. And what the political parties have got to do is start addressing the problems of the working class and the middle class of this country rather than hustling money from billionaires.
What do you most fear about a Trump presidency?
I fear that this country will be increasingly divided up in terms of bigotry, that Americans will be lashing out at other Americans because of where they came from or their religion or whether they're a woman or whatnot. Our job, I think Secretary Clinton understands this, is to bring our people together to address the real problems facing our country, not to divide us up. That's the difference.
Senator Bernie Sanders, thank you for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. After 3 years of writing, arranging, and recording, Red Tail Rings, Michael Beauchamp, and Laurel Primo are out with their new album. It's called Fall Away Blues. This album brings new folk songs on subjects ranging from gun violence and fracking to our deepest relationships and a changing sense of place, along with old traditional ballads and tunes. Here's the duo talking about their new music.
Well, Fall Away Blues is the title track of the new record, and it's a tune that I wrote. The form of it is based off of a traditional tune that's been sung as a nursery rhyme for many years, all about, I don't know, kind of persevering through any hardship, or that's how I interpreted it.
If I should lose most everything, tell you what I would do, pull some more.
But that original one, I'm sure you'll recognize, it's "Hush, little baby, don't say a word. Papa's gonna buy you a mockingbird. Say, darling, say. And if that mockingbird don't sing, Papa's gonna buy you a diamond ring. Say, darling, say." And it's making happiness with whatever you have available. So in my tune, I took that a little further and just spoke about a life and persevering through whatever is thrown your direction.
And if you silenced all my sound, I'd tell you what I would do. I'd dance all night and never sit down. Fall away, fall away.
Another kind of deeply personal song on the album is called Gibson Town, and Laurel and I wrote it following the February Kalamazoo mass shooting that happened. And after that, a few days after that, Laurel and I attended a vigil at a church downtown. It was a citywide vigil. It was there were tons of people there, and we were really greatly affected by the community coming together and just trying to heal from that horrific event. And we really, of course, as Kalamazooans, and my hometown is Kalamazoo, so we were really deeply disturbed and bothered by the mass shooting. So we went home that night and wrote the lyrics to Gibson Town.
Oh, Lord, oh, well.
And Gibson Town was a melody that we'd been playing as a banjo duet. It actually comes from a Muddy Waters of an old blues tune called Catfish Blues. We just kind of took the melody and ran from there and names it Gibson Town, of course, after the long home of Gibson guitars being in Kalamazoo.
One interesting piece that we recorded on this project is an almost completely a cappella tune, but it has fiddle in it as the third voice. And it's another tune that I wrote that we call The New Home Place. And this is actually a song that we tried to put on our last album, but it just didn't come through with the tone that we thought it deserved. We just couldn't record it in a way that we thought served the piece, so we kept trying, you know, since the 3 years since the last album. And I'm really happy that now on this record it's presented in its purest form.
Laurel Primo and Michael Beauchamp are Red Tail Ring. Their new album is called Fall Away Blues. There's a CD release event this Friday, October 7th, on the west side of the state in Spring Lake, right near Grand Haven. You can find out more on our website. Just go to michiganradio.org. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was born in the throes of Detroit's bankruptcy, an idea to take the aging, debt-ridden Detroit Water and Sewerage Department and transform it to a regional entity. The Great Lakes Water Authority, or GLEWA for short, seems to be stoking a true spirit of cooperation in Southeast Michigan and performing the way its designers hoped it would. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here with us. Daniel, why is it so important that this regional water authority be a success?
Well, I think we've seen through the Flint water crisis, certainly, and the battle over water in Southeast Michigan, how important this resource is to the entire community, to everyone, business, residents, rich, poor, black, white, suburb, city, doesn't matter. And this has been a problem for a real long time. And I think I'm very encouraged that this is one of the fruits of the bankruptcy, as I think of it, that we've gotten to the other side here. They've been able to put together an organization that respects the fact that Detroit still owns the assets of its huge sprawling water system, but this authority helps run it and pays lease payments every year to the city of Detroit. And those lease payments do not go into the general fund, cannot be spent on whatever the city wants to spend them on. It has to be spent on the water system. And I think everybody, at least so far in the first 9 months, is pretty happy with it.
Take us back, Daniel, to those days during the bankruptcy and mm-hmm. spell out the reasons for the transformation.
When the city went into bankruptcy, one of the things that a lot of us wrote about, and I certainly spent a lot of time on, was underscoring the fact that the city didn't really have a lot of assets. There is this assumption that it had all these great jewels and all these assets, but in a bankruptcy, you're looking for what kind of cash and tangible assets do you have? The Detroit Institute of Arts was one of them, and we know we've talked many times on your show about that fight. Mm-hmm. The water system was another. And at one point, emergency manager Kevin Orr and some of his negotiators were pressing people to explore the possibility of selling the water system to a private entity and therefore a municipal utility that serves 40% of the population of the entire state would have been privately owned. The city clearly didn't want to do that. And the counties, Oakland County, Macomb, and principally Wayne, those three, but there are other counties, including Washtenaw, including Lapeer, Genesee, who had dogs in the fight, if you will, because they were customers, but they didn't have, they weren't as big a customers as the others. They didn't want to see that happen because it conjured up a whole host of other issues where you'd have a private entity that would be taking over the system, jacking up rates, not taking care of the system. So I think there was an incentive to begin negotiations. Well, the person who was initially negotiating for Kevin Orr was a very difficult customer, and they weren't getting anywhere. In reporting this column, I talked with Bob Datta, who's now the chairman of the Great Lakes Water Authority, who's a deputy county executive in Oakland County. And he said what really changed everything was Mayor Mike Duggan. And then when Mike Duggan got involved about a year into these negotiations, as he put it, he stuck his head into one of these negotiations, and all of a sudden things began to change. Now, whatever people may think about the mayor, I happen to think he's a pretty savvy and pragmatic guy and always looks for how he can find the benefit and what makes sense to get a deal done, not to screw the other side, but to get a deal done that's good for all sides. And the thing, the key piece for him was to say, okay, rather than this authority paying the city and pumping money into the general fund, which they did not want to do, they did not want their revenue being used to fund the operations of the city, per se, but they would be willing to have their revenue fund the capital improvements of the water system, of which they were members.
Which was perfect because it needed it.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that they began to do, and that is really kind of the linchpin of the deal that's made it work. It's early days, but you know, they're going to market next week. They expect to sell about $1.4 billion in bonds. And in the last week or so, you've had the three most important ratings agencies have come along and said, you know what, not only do we say that this is stable, but we're going to be looking for upgrades here, which is something that clearly has has not happened in recent history in Detroit in terms of the city or its water system.
Now, there was a price to pay here, though, wasn't there? I mean, a lot of people wound up losing their jobs. I saw in your column what the workforce was cut by nearly 40%.
Yeah, and, you know, there are, were legendary stories of things that were going on in the water department during the bankruptcy. I think there was one story, and you may have talked about it on your show, of somebody who I think was a horseshoer, was a union of one person who was a horseshoer. They haven't had horses in the water department in God knows how long. But it was viewed as really a repository of patronage within the city. And I think one of the things they clearly wanted to do was to clean it out, rationalize the workforce. There was a lot of expense associated with the workforce. They also restructured a number of their functions, including finance and IT and purchasing, because they wanted transparency. And that was the other thing the counties insisted on, led really in a lot of ways by Oakland County, which has got a very robust financial management system and has got one of the highest bond ratings of any county in the country. They're very savvy in that way, and they insisted on that, and that's one of the things they're doing. But you're right, the cost has been that a lot fewer people have jobs there than did, you know, certainly 10 years ago.
And for the some 4 million people who rely on GLEWA for their water, what does this mean?
Well, I think for one thing, and I think, you know, are they going to continue to get service? Yes. Are they going to probably continue to see their bills go up at least a little bit every year? Probably. But I don't think there's any question that you're getting more transparency and the place is going to be better managed. And I think that's really important because it's been, in a lot of ways, a really backwardly managed utility for a very long time.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
Collaborative. Experimentation.
The next idea.
We need a participation revolution, and we need it fast.
How do you help a preschooler succeed in school when his or her parents are immigrants? They may not even speak English. The answer, you help the kids succeed by coaching the parents, by guiding parent and child. An innovative program in Dearborn and Detroit is doing exactly that with great success. The Arab Community Center for Economic and Social Services, ACCESS, put together a team of educators and social workers, and they developed a way to get recent immigrant families ready for school, parents and preschoolers. They call the program Parent and Child Interactive Learning, PICL for short. Amanda Morgan helped to develop this program, and
She's now on the faculty of the School of Social Work at Michigan State University. Welcome, Amanda.
Hello.
Good to have you with us. And Thoraya Al-Hagam is one of the parents who has been part of the PICL program. She immigrated from Yemen to Michigan 7 years ago. Thank you so much for joining us today, Thoraya.
Thank you.
Amanda, what was the problem that you were trying to solve in developing this program?
In Detroit, we noticed that there were high rates of illiteracy among adults, and the children that were entering kindergarten all over Detroit were not ready for school. They were not ready to perform academically. They were not ready socially and emotionally. And this was particularly challenging for high immigrant population communities. There were many school readiness programs out there and approaches and some two-generation programs out there. But what Access aimed to do was to look at the unique challenges that faced immigrant communities and build a program from the ground up that was two-generation, that incorporated the parents' learning with the children and teaching the parents how to become their child's first teacher in the home, empowering the parents to learn themselves and teach their children how to get ready for school.
This closes a big, big gap, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really helps the parents build their skills so that they can go on with their education, they can get jobs, they can, you know, provide for their families and build stable environments for their kids to continue learning, not just to get ready for school that initial year, but to really continue on with their academic success. We know that one of the largest predictors of a child's academic success is the reading level of their mother. So when we are working with these parents, Access has been providing English as a second language classes for parents in the community for over 20 years. And we're seeing that, you know, when you empower these parents, you're creating this environment and this family for these kids. So when you teach them how to be the teachers for their children and you give them these strategies and then you coach them and mentor them to get their children ready for school, you're not just working with their kid in this bubble. You're really giving the parents the skills and abilities to do that for this child and any future children to come.
How did you construct the program? What does it look like? And how do you get to the families?
Kind of the traditional approach for a school readiness program is to bring the kids into a preschool setting and work with them. Some of the newer school readiness programs is to incorporate this two-generation approach of bringing in the parents. But even those two-generation approaches that we looked at, those mainstream approaches, were just too fast-paced. The vocabulary is too difficult for a population who doesn't have high English language skills. There's just not enough time. There's not enough mentoring and coaching. Those were really things that we took a look at. We made sure that the program had three key elements. One, teaching the parents the content. So making sure that the parents did know the English alphabet. They did know the shapes and the colors themselves. They knew how to pronounce them correctly and draw them and identify them. They knew what the words trace and match meant and how to use them correctly, and allowing them time to practice that content and those strategies, mentoring and coaching the parents. So the parents learn that content separately from their children. They're given that time. And then we bring the parents and children together and we give them interactive activities with that content to do together. During that time that they're practicing those strategies, we have teachers in the classroom that are coaching and mentoring those parents. The entire time building awareness with those parents around what does it mean to be ready for school? What does it mean when we say children should start learning from birth? How do children develop? How do their brains develop? How do they develop physically? What are some things they should be doing? So all three of those key elements were built into the program from the very beginning.
Is it over a long period of time?
It's pretty concentrated. It's a 10-week course. You know, we can't fit everything in. You have from 0 to 5 to get your kid ready for school, really. We know that it's not realistic that parents are going to bring their kid to our program for 5 years. But in that 10-week session, our focus is really teaching parents how to do these things at home. We're teaching them the strategies and empowering them to be able to do these things, but really to take those things and do them at home and not teaching them with these expensive materials and things that they're not going to have access to. really teaching them with things that they can do in their home. So teaching them how to teach a rectangle by pointing out a cereal box, or that the door looks like a rectangle, and so that when they leave, they're able to continue this after they leave the program.
Let me turn now to Thoraya Al-Hagam. As you were in this program, Thoraya, what did you like about it?
I liked it a lot because it gave me confidence, helped me teach my kids, to teach them how to be ready for school.
What kinds of things would you do in the classes with them?
We do a lot of things like reading, coloring, matching and stuff, shapes sometimes, a lot of things.
And are you doing things with your children now that you weren't doing before Pickle?
Yeah, we're doing a lot, like rhyming inside the house, getting the same word have same ending, sometimes counting the stairs, counting the doors inside the house. A lot of fun things and we're doing that right now. It's more fun to us to learn, fun to me and fun my kids to be with together, learning more and more for school.
Thoraya, how old are your children?
I have 6 and 5 now. He turned 5 like months ago.
And they're in class now. How are they doing in school? What level are they at and how are they doing?
The first one, kindergarten. The other one, pre-kindergarten. Both of them same level, but they're doing great. The kindergarten one is start reading. The under one, he start holding pen, writing letters, draw. Before he doesn't like even hold the pen. Now he's doing better.
And how about you, Thoraya? How did this process and this program, how did it change you?
It gave me the confidence. It helped me to understand children better, helped me to have the confidence to teach my kids. And if I don't know how to help them, I have the resource to ask, to know how to do with them if I have a problem or something I couldn't do with them.
Amanda Morgan, over the years, the 4 years that this program has been going on at Access, have you seen this program impact ways that recent immigrants begin to feel more at ease, maybe a greater sense of belonging to their new home in Michigan?
Yeah, we have the program located in a Detroit public school, and it's located right in their neighborhood. We try to encourage the parents to be involved with the school, to go to parent meetings at the school, to be involved with the teachers and the administrators. We send staff to parent-teacher conferences to translate for the parents. We go over differences between American school systems and school systems in their home country, and we've just seen a huge, significant difference with their comfort level, between interacting with the schools. It's very different. Everything is very different from where they come from. And so just the comfort level of them with the school systems, and the parents are in English as a second language classes as a part of this program, and their comfort level going into the community, going to banks and to grocery stores and feeling empowered to get their driver's license and become U.S. citizens, and just the empowerment that they get from this program and the confidence that they receive just all around, but especially as a part of helping their children and being involved in their education is significant.
Is this a program that you think could be translatable to really any immigrant in any community in our state?
Yes, and I think not just our state, but country. Primarily, our population that we worked with were Arabic and Latino Spanish-speaking students, but we were very intentional from the beginning that we wanted the program to be applicable to all immigrants. We made sure that we built it in a way that it could be used for a diverse group of people. We made sure that the structure, that the time built in to learn and practice, that the content, the way that it was taught for English language learners, everything was done very intentionally so that it could be replicated with a variety of other immigrant populations. And that's what, moving forward, that's what we hope to do. We just published a book on the program, and we hope that we're able to take that book and replicate it in other communities across the country.
And that new book is called Access to School. So tell us, how can people learn more about the program or perhaps get that book?
It's available on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and they can also visit our website, accesscommunity.org, to learn more.
Amanda Morgan helped to develop the PICL program, Parent and Child Interactive Learning Program with Access in Dearborn. And Thuraya Alhagam is a mother of two. She took part in the program with her two children after emigrating from Yemen to Michigan. We want to thank both of you for being with us today on The Next Idea. It was great to have you.
Thank you so much.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Desiree Cooper once practiced law at a leading Detroit firm, but her writer's heart kept pushing her toward her calling, first as a columnist and editor at the Metro Times, and then as a columnist for the Detroit Free Press. She's been a commentator on All Things Considered here on NPR and was a correspondent for the BBC. Now Desiree's out with a stunning book of short stories, flash stories, short and powerful. The collection is called Know the Mother. These 31 stories explore gender, explore race. Here's Desiree Cooper reading her flash story, The Witching Hour.
Why do we wake each night in that spiritless moment between worlds, we mothers, daughters, and wives? And why does the night abandon us to such twinkling worry, to the rattling breaths of our children, to the hard floor of our long prayers? What fresh dangers tap against the black window? And why do our men snore so easily as the horror gathers? Why is it always at 3:15 that evil drags us from beneath the red wine or white pills to make us sit up and see the world so clearly? Who comes to whisper our names and turn our blood to sludge? Where is the mercy for those of us who lie awake, weeping in the eternal hours before the crucifixion?
Desiree Cooper, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
That story, I open up the book. There it was on page one, and I thought, oh my goodness, she knows. She knows what it's like.
You wake up at 3:15, don't you?
I'm usually somewhere around 3
yeah.
and stare at the ceiling. My friend Debbie calls it, there you are, staring at the ceiling. And your husband is happily snoring away, and you envy that, and you cannot shut off your mind. And you captured that.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't stop that middle of the night worry.
No.
Why is it called The Witching Hour?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's folklore about this. So evidently, Jesus was crucified. This is in the Christian world. Jesus was crucified around 3:15 in the afternoon. So exactly 12 hours before that, half a day before that, is 3:15 in the morning. And so that is supposed to be the most evil time of the 24-hour period. So that is the time where those spirits are gathering and where you just wake up and your eyes are like wide open and
whatever's
all that.
On your mind.
And quite often it's like the worst of the worst. You know, for some reason you can't think, wow, I'm going to have ice cream tomorrow and it's going to be blah, blah, blah.
You worry about the kids. You worry about your job. You worry about life. You worry about your parents. You worry, worry, worry.
The horrors gather.
That
so I wanted to start the collection with that because that is a fairly universal phenomenon, even though scientifically or sociologically we can't really explain it, but it's such a common experience that I wanted to just start a tone at the beginning of this is who we are as women in particular, and no matter who we are, this is what we do.
It is universal. You offer such emotional reflections about being a woman, about being a wife, a mother, a daughter. What pointed you in that direction for this collection, Know the Mother?
Being a wife, mother, and daughter. I wrote the title poem up. I call it a poem because it started as a poem. And many of these kind of walk the line between poetry and prose. But this is actually prose. But the title piece called Know the Mother, I actually wrote that 20 years ago. And it was before my own mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's and before I was what I call not the sandwich generation, but the hero sandwich generation, where we are, so many of us are caught between aging parents, our own millennials who haven't launched, and their families, so grands as well. So there's many generations that we're carrying with us. And I think that stepping into these roles, every time a new layer was added, it was a new shock for me that, wait, are you serious? Like, now I have to pick this up too?
Now I'm a grandma.
And juggling all that with work. And then where are you? Where's your own personal desire in all this? And how do you become who you were meant to be in the middle of helping everyone else become. So that's kind of a theme that very much runs through all the pieces.
And these pieces, there's so many stories that you could say, oh, I could see this in my life, or I know someone. We've got a lawyer in the middle of a conference call carrying on even as she begins to miscarry. A daughter accepting the death of her mother. We have a mother sitting by the window imagining all manner of horrors while she waits for her teenage daughter to come home. We've got a young pregnant wife with her marriage dissolving right out from under her, with a husband who doesn't want to be a father. So these are not happy, carefree moments that you're sharing with us, these stories.
You know, I wish I could just, you know, write happy, happy, joy, joy. But I guess that's what we have the other things in life for, your friends and your diversions. Mm. I think sometimes what fiction can do is articulate a truth that you just don't even dare talk about, or that maybe sometimes you think it's only you. And some people have said to me reading some of these, it's like, wow, like, how can you say that? Or even when I talk about the book, I'll reveal things about myself. Right. And I'm like, because I'm not alone, because I didn't invent this. And for me, there's like, why are we so quiet and heroic about our suffering? I think that
we keep on keeping on.
Yeah. But, you know, by virtue of that, we keep the world going around, but we also stop the world from catching up to us. We do not hold the world accountable. I always say that there was a women's movement, but nothing else moved. And so we took this great leap and left everything behind. And so the universe is back there saying, see ya, have a good time. You didn't ask us if we wanted to come along, because we don't. So the institutions haven't moved. Our relationships, our partnerships haven't moved. How we deal with any kind of social relationships have not stepped up to where women are living in their heads
and
in their hearts.
How much of your real life is reflected in these stories? I mean, are these at all autobiographical?
Well, I do want to say that every story here is my truth, even if it didn't happen to me.
Did it happen to people you knew?
Yes. Okay. Or to people I've heard about. Mm-hmm. I mean, or in groups. I've spent a lot of time in women's social groups. And I've heard the stories of the mothers and the wives and the daughters, and I've lived those lives. So even if it's not my truth, there's a story there about a woman that's recovering from breast cancer. And yes. I'm not a survivor. I do have friends that are survivors. But how can we not have all been touched by that and in some way have some knowing or dread or preconception about what that's like?
I'm speaking with Desiree Cooper about her new book of short stories, a collection called Know the Mother, exploring gender, exploring race. And I love the way you describe these flash stories. They're very short, very, and you have to get in, do your job, and get out. What drew you to that, to writing in that format versus longer stories or novellas or even a novel?
I've tried novellas. I've had two novellas published to mixed results. Ever since I was a little girl, and I mean little, like four, I've wanted to be a writer. And I tried longer forms. But as I was growing up and coming into my own, there's that middle class striving of, that's really cute. Now, what are you really going to be when you grow up? So I ended up in law and then in journalism, all finding my way around what I know now is storytelling.
You had to find your way back.
I had to find my way back. But so then I'm ready, right? Mm. Okay, I'm back. I'm ready. And I've been spoiled because I've been writing compressed form for so long. And so there's not a novel in me. I've got to kind of use that muscle I've been using for column length. And that's how I have learned to tell stories. So a lot of people think it's hard, and it is hard for some people to compress. For me, it's harder to write long because I think in a compressed form.
Yeah, you really have a gorgeous way of telling truth with just a few words. And your morphing, it fascinates me, from attorney to editor, columnist to writer and poet. I know you're a founding board member of Cave Canem, a national residency for emerging Black poets. I love that name, Beware of the Dog.
Yes.
I love that. What does that work mean to you?
Oh, my gosh. Cave Canem changed my life. If you've heard of a Black poet winning a Pulitzer, speaking at the inauguration, being published anywhere, if they're African-American, 9 times out of 10, they've been through Cave Canem. It has been such a big influence on the arts and letters in America, pushing black voices to the fore so that they are no longer marginalized. I was lucky because of my legal background. I was asked to serve on the board to help this fledgling organization that's now over 20 years old get started. And I say I always breathe the air of poets. And I would go back to my desk at the Free Press and think, what can I bring from that poetry into my journalism? And it was huge. It was a huge influence. Even though I couldn't use a lot of adjectives in journalism, the imagery came with me. And there were times I would do a column as a poem and then blow it out as a column so that I knew exactly. It was almost like an outline where I needed to go with the commentary. So
Your way with words. I love when you were writing as the mother is waiting for her daughter to come home and she imagines herself talking to a police officer at the door. My daughter is easy to recognize. She's the one with her heart beating in my pocket.
Yeah.
And as the mother of a 22-year-old, I know what that's like when they're out. And they need to be out. They need to do their thing. But you imagine things. Your stories, some of them in this collection, give us an absolutely heart-rending sense of what it meant and means to have black or brown skin. And The Disappearing Girl, as the mother of a daughter, got me so hard. Would you read that story for us, Desiree Cooper?
Sure. My minivan churns impatiently as I wait in the long queue. Up ahead, it's easy to spot my daughter in the gaggle of starched, school-crested shirts and navy blue pants. She's the only one with brown eyes and skin to match. She's the only one whose thick black hair is tamed into stiff braids. She is standing apart, her eyes scanning the row of cars, a refugee on a hostile shore waiting for an airlift. When she finally sees our car, she shoulders her heavy book bag, too full of academic pressure for a fourth grader, and a smile lands on her face. She's not ashamed to show me her beautiful Wallace gap in her front teeth. She waves desperately, as if I might otherwise miss her, the lone black child in a sea of white. Finally, she opens the door and jumps into the back seat. How was your day? I say brightly, swallowing the stress of having to pick her up from private school every afternoon. She buckles in and opens her daily treat. Today it's a bag of Doritos and bottled tea. No time to get to the store for apples. Bad mom. She says nothing but munches quietly and looks out the window. We pass the blonde girls yelling things out of car windows like, call me if you want to go riding, or don't forget your swimsuit. At 10, my daughter wants more than anything to be chosen. She has a crush on Henry Frank. The kids call him Hank Frank as if it were one word. My daughter has a chance with Hank Frank because he's funny, goofy, already eccentric, probably gay. I turn off the radio, which I always do when the kids are in the car, just in case something bubbles up from their mysterious lives. Lately, my daughter has become impenetrable. When I hug her, she stiffens. Even though I am her lifeboat, she will not touch me. She is the kind of lonely that cannot be explained, so it becomes someone else's fault. Mine. Did you know that I'm invisible? Her words come in a scratchy little girl voice, but she's too old for make-believe. She's stating a fact. My heart is a block of ice. I glance at her in the rearview mirror. My daughter finishes her Doritos and crumples up the bag loudly. I stop the car in front of the manicured lawn of a stranger. I get out and open my daughter's door. She tracks me wide-eyed, afraid that she's in trouble. I unlock her seatbelt and I pull her out of the car. Her classmates peer at us curiously as they drive by in their mom's SUVs. She doesn't know it yet, but after today, my daughter will never see them again. I take her shoulders and gaze into her eyes. I look at her so long that the hard resentment of her spine bends toward me. Her anger softens to tears. I can see you, I say, taking her into my arms.
That's Desiree Cooper reading from her collection of short stories, Know the Mother. So powerful, Desiree. And that one, it got me when I read it. It got me as I hear you reading. you were awarded a Kresge Artists Fellowship in 2015, which was a big deal for you as a writer. What did that $25,000 grant allow you to do with your writing?
Well, aside from the money, which was huge, and I'll talk about that in a second, you know, it was a coming out party for me because so many people saw me as a journalist and people didn't know I was a creative writer. And so, I mean, even to this day, people think I got that award for journalism. And it was that moment when I'm like, no, here I am, looky. And to have that kind of recognition for something that I had basically kept to myself for so long was huge. I was able to, as many people did, get some bills behind me. Mm-hmm. And it coincided with this book, which was already in the works before I got the Kresge. So with the money, I was able to hire some support to get the word out about the book and to kind of position me so that I could get out and talk about it. And they also do a video of every artist, and they were willing to make my video a book trailer.
Perfect.
So who gets a book trailer, you know, for their, especially their first book? So they have been extraordinary. We have met regularly as a group, and so I get to know the fellow artist. There's a lot of work around trying to shift your paradigm so that art is primary in your life and not sort of an adjunct to what you're doing. And that has been extraordinary. I'm so grateful to them.
So what's next?
Oh gosh.
Now that this is gelling in this way, I mean, this wonderful collection of short stories, you're doing book tours, you're meeting people, and I'm sure having conversations that must be inspiring you towards new writings.
Well, I'm wondering if some essays might come out of this. You asked me earlier if these were my stories, and they're sort of taken from a nugget of thought or feeling or truth that I had. But there are some like real hard truths that I'm living through now with my parents and with grandparenting and parenting still. And, you know, making my way in a very tough economy now as an older person. I'm 56 now. And a whole bunch of things around that. And they're kind of coming out as I talk to women about this book. And I'm thinking I might want to collect some essays around those topics.
Oh, we can't wait to read it. When you do and you get that published, you get back here and talk about them. Desiree Cooper's collection of short stories, but really flash stories, which really tell you what you need to know about the format. Know the Mother loved it. Thank you so much for sharing them with us on Stateside.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And we always want to hear from you. What stories are you focusing on or issues that you want to hear more about? Let us know. You can find us on Facebook, search for Stateside. We're on Twitter, at Stateside Radio. And as always, MichiganRadio.org, and just click on the link that says Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Ryan Grimes, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, and Liz Dickey. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.